David, it's David DeSmith calling.
Yeah, hi.
How are you?
No, I'm fine. Good.
Good. Well, listen, thanks for taking time out from the tour to speak to me. I know that you've got kind of a hellish schedule. I appreciate it.
Right. Okay.
So, I want to talk to you about Pere Ubu's new album, Lady from Shanghai, and your current tour in a moment. I really like the new album. It feels very cinematic to me. I picture a lot of different things, images and scenes, when I listen to it. But if it's okay, a couple of quick background questions about things I've been wondering about for anywhere between 2 days and 35 years. You started Pere Ubu in Cleveland back in 75, and as everybody knows, there was an incredibly vibrant rock music scene in Cleveland in those days, and a lot of new territory being explored.
I'm not sure. This is a total mischaracterization. It wasn't a vibrant scene. There's three or four bands and a bunch of cover bands, and, you know, it was pretty hopeless, but that's okay. You can say post facto it was vibrant, but I'm not aware that it was terribly vibrant.
Okay. Well, it's in retrospect, I guess, in the media, it's been characterized that way, probably because of your success.
Right.
You've talked in the past about Goulardi, Cleveland's maestro misterioso TV movie show host, and his effect on you. You know, what was happening in Cleveland then unique in your opinion? You know, a lake effect. It seemed to me that compared to things I was hearing from other parts of the country at the time, the music coming out of that scene, small though it may have been, seemed maybe a bit darker, more satirical, maybe, than what I was hearing elsewhere?
Well, number one, Goulardi was in 66 or so, and, you know, the music scene that you're referring to is 74, 75, something in there. So, you know, the scene, yeah, I don't know. You know, it's talking about it now is just sort of, I mean, in lots of ways, pointless. Nobody was there. Hardly anybody who's there is still alive anymore. It was the bands were extreme, and there's a certain amount of anger and independence and. And mostly the anger was directed at other rock bands, you know, the bands that were playing all the clubs and playing, you know, whatever the hits of the day, cover bands, you know.
Yeah.
There wasn't any particular social, you know, element to it. You know, it was, you know, everybody thought something better should be happening than was happening, and they all approached that in their own ways.
Okay. Yeah, it just...
I'm sorry it's not some sort of, you know, media template sort of answer. That's my take on it, and I'm sure other people have other takes. You know what I mean?
No, I do. I guess, you know, it just strikes me that, you know, listening to that music of, you know, certainly Rocket from the Tombs and Mirrors and Electric Eels and, you know, Davey and the Cool Marriage Counselors, that there was something there that was different than what I was hearing from, you know, Miracle Legion or Mission of Burma back in, you know, the Boston area in those days.
Well, it felt darker. The scene was dependent on very strong characters. There was this notion, you know, that I talk about in the Goulardi article, the lecture, that of the extreme host persona, you know, who is the nexus of performance. You know, the band perceives the outside world through the singer, and the audience perceives the band inside world through the singer, you know, and the notion of the extreme host, you know, mediating the experience. I think that, you know, that accounts for the fact that there's some pretty damn extreme people that were host, you know, that were the singers of the bands and members of the bands, you know, and the fact that it was a very competitive scene. There wasn't, you know, you could at the most, you could hope to play once every 3 months or something, and that meant every show had to be brilliant. There could be no, you know, because you were going up against the two or three other bands, and if you weren't the best, then it was a humiliation, you know. So
yeah,
it was an intensely, you know, competitive in a way that you had to, you know, you had to be the best all the time, and any failure should and would be punished severely with scorn.
Got it. Okay.
Even if they liked you, you know, they would still, you know, say, oh, that wasn't as good as, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Sure.
That environment encourages, you know, toughness and crap, you know. You can tell I've kind of been over this a lot. I'm not trying to be unfriendly or anything, but I've been over this damn thing a lot.
Yeah, and I know you don't like to dwell on the past, so enough about that. Let's talk for a second about, you know, about your content. You know, on the Worlds in Collision album, there's a song called Cry, 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 in which you sing about playing the part of the broken man. And it seems to me that many of your songs through the years have zeroed in on similar aspects of the human experience, failed romances, dreams that don't come true, pants that don't fit. But my question is, often, you know, there seems to be a countervailing sort of element of humor that's inherent to those songs. Is that something I'm imagining?
No, of course not. I mean, the fact that we use humor, I mean, it's not even like you use humor. On a craft level, you use humor to set the audience up for the next, you know, the next horror or the next tragedy or something. You know, you keep bouncing them around, their head against the wall, that sort of stuff. I mean, that's the object of a performance, you know, is to subject the audience to a series of stimuli and experiences, and so that in the end it becomes a very Skinnerian behavioralist sort of attack on the each individual in the audience. You know, that in absolutely strictly truthful terms is what everybody does, whether they know it or not. So, you know, we use humor tactically, but also it's just part of the human experience. It's part of the thing that's almost distinctive to Pere Ubu is the sort of God's eye perspective that we use in the songs. You know, that everything is slightly removed from the individual is removed from himself and sees himself, you know, in a different perspective, you know, and sometimes that's comical, you know, sometimes the horror is comical, you know, sometimes the horror is horrible.
Yeah.
Or tragic, you know. So that's that perspective, what used to be known as the God's eye perspective, you know, is, you know, of seeing yourself doing things and saying to yourself, oh, this is just, you know, you're not doing that again, are you? You know, that sort of perspective is pretty distinctively Pere Ubu, and it goes from the beginning, from 1975 to right now, you know. That's so...
Right.
I'm not sure if that answers your question, because I can't remember your question.
No, I think it does, and it brings up another thought, which is that, you know, I feel like there's also, you know, a real sense of optimism and, you know, maybe even a spirit of celebration in many of those plaintive songs, at least the way they're presented from a musical standpoint. You know, musically, many of them feel upbeat and bright, despite the despair that the lyrics may be communicating.
I'm not sure we ever do despair. I mean, I think that's what you're perceiving. You know, I don't use despair, you know. Number two, these songs are stories. You know,
yeah.
I've got in the 300-something songs in my solo and Ubu career, I've only written two that are personal. You know, these are stories, and this is one of the really maddening things about pop culture is that an audience is if the audience thinks, you know, it comes from the singer-songwriter thing, you know, that these songs are some sort of, you know, heartfelt ode to, you know, the tragedy and existential experience of my fucking life. You know, no, they're stories. You know, it
right.
didn't happen to me. You know, they're people. I mean, you know, they're people, and you know, we all live in ghost towns these days. That's the nature of modern society. That's the nature of what's happened with technology and all that other stuff. And so, in the end, lots of us live in ghost towns, you know, and ghost towns are places that are inhabited by people who are removed from the string of time, and they've dropped out of time. That's what a ghost is, you know. So,
yeah.
I'm not sure what the damn question was. What do you want to know? I'm in New York fucking city, and so I'm a little bit aggressive. I'm not taking this out on you. You're cool. I'm just, you know, yeah.
Well, you need to be on your guard down there for sure. Let me ask you about something you said that really intrigued me, and I'm not sure that I understood it, and I'm not sure that I'm capable of understanding. But you said in the past, you talked about the fundamental importance of, quote, manipulating the space of sound and the sound of space
right.
with your voice.
Mm-hmm.
Could you elaborate just for a minute on the relation, you know, as you see it, between sound and space, that geography of sound? I believe you called it.
Well, sound is a mirror of space. You know, sound is a description of space. That's, you know, sound only happens as a consequence of space. If you have space, you will have sound. You know, so that the relationship of sound in space, or in other terms, geography, is intimate. You know, they are almost, you know, in the role of the singer in an ideal world, which is the world that I inhabit, you know, and that every other fucking singer on the planet should know about, is that, you know, the job of the singer is to manipulate time and space, you know, is to understand, you know, the shape of the space that it. I mean, because when a band is playing on stage in a concert hall, you know, it's more obvious on a recording. But in a live situation, the band is creating a virtual space with the sound. It's working, and the singer is particularly, you know, necessary to give meaning to that space, to nail down, you know, why we're in that space at that particular point in the song. That's what you know, all the great ones did. You know, if you look at Frank Sinatra, every moment is he's on a rocket ride in terms of his manipulation of time. I can't go into it any further. It's you know, I wrote endless numbers of pages about it in a theoretical and philosophical sense, and it's really difficult to just...
Yeah, I hear you.
...offer a soundbite.
No, fair enough. I appreciate that. You know, I've always felt that what some people might hear in Pere Ubu's music and call weird is actually perfectly mimetic, in that the mirror that it holds up to this, the circumstances of modern life, you know, provides not only an artistic but an accurate reflection of what it's like to live on 21st century Earth. But at the same time,
you stated what I would answer. Whatever the question is, that's my answer. But go ahead.
Well, at the same time, it occurs to me that one of the things Pere Ubu's music does, while it's exploring or explaining the mysteries of life, is to make them even more mysterious at the same time. It's like Yeats's you know, intertwining gyres, where the more something is explained, the more mystery surrounding it deepens. You know, is that a dynamic that you are, you know, sort of overtly conscious of as you develop music for Pere Ubu?
Conscious of it, yes, of course. I mean, not in those sort of theoretical terms. I mean, I would describe it in different terms, but you're right.
All right.
I like these kind of questions where you answer it yourself.
Well, I don't mean to do that.
No, it's okay.
But it's better than being wrong.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the new album, Lady from Shanghai.
I need to wrap this up pretty quickly, do a hurry on you or anything.
Okay. I wanted to
Shanghai.
Yeah, I wanted to ask a question about something that I don't believe there's been a lot of information disseminated about, which is the whole polemic appeal about smashing the hegemony of dance. You know, I know that in the past, Ubu has certainly smashed or at least poked holes in the hegemonies of harmony and melody. But in terms of the polemic to stand still.
Hello?
Yes.
Hello? Okay. Well, I'm not sure if I got the last part of that. It all relates, the use of that is, you have to understand, it refers to the poster, the famous Rita Hayworth poster for Lady from Shanghai. And the poster said, I can't remember it. Anyway, it has to do with there's too much going on around me to think. It's a clue to the meaning of what we're working on and what the meaning of the record is. That's what lots of these things are. They're clues. Explain what it is, but I give people a clue, a really good clue, and that's a pretty damn good clue. And if I could remember the Rita Hayworth poster, I'd tell you that, because then it'd be really very obvious. But I can't. It doesn't. I think it's something like. I can't remember it.
That's all right, David. I'll try to look it up. One last question, and then I'll let you go. How's that?
Thank you very much.
You bet. No, thank you. I've heard and read where you rail against spoon-fed globalized multiculturalism, the homogenization of cultures as a result of the media, and other mechanisms of our Orwellian world. So the question is, if Crocus Behemoth could come back and do what Paubu couldn't, i.e. rule the world, What would it look like? What would your best of all possible worlds be?
Well, that kind of doesn't matter, because no matter what your intentions are, and your heart says, you're going to end up screwing it up. it's going to be a mess anyway. So that's why I have no interest in campaigning for things or any of that. And that's part of the meaning. I mean, remember the third line of that thing, the dancer is puppet to the dance. That's the key, the answer to that to your question is the dancer is puppet to the dance.
Very good.
What's the solution? Stand still.
There you go. All right. Thank you, David. Good luck with tonight's show in New York, and we look forward to seeing you and the band up in New England this weekend.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah. Bye now.
Bye.